Okay, let's discuss the main event. TJ Dillashaw, Corey Sandhagen. Fairly even fight through the first three rounds. Fourth and fifth round were the difference makers. I watched these back, not frame by frame, but when it required a frame by frame look to get a grasp at who was having the more effective striking. The grappling really did not come into play in this fight. I used some screen by screen. And if I was scoring this one, Sandhagen had the win. He won the fourth and the fifth in my book. And I just replayed those two rounds because the judges had scored the first three rounds the same. And so I looked at the difference-making rounds, and here's what I came up with. The fourth round, Daniel Cormier said in the fourth round that Dillashaw's leg kicks were a difference-maker. But as far as judging criteria, they were not a difference-maker. They did not go towards Dillashaw finishing in the fight. They were effective in that they landed, but they did not cause damage. They did not slow Sandhagen down. They did not cause him to switch stances. And that way, the strikes were ineffective. Sandhagen's striking was much more effective in the fourth round. It seemed like every time Sandhagen connected, Dillashaw's head snapped back. And that might be perception. But every strike that Sandhagen, not every strike, but the power strikes that Sandhagen landed were more powerful and were more effective than Dillashaw's. I don't know how someone can question that just because of how he reacted to the strikes. They were snapping his head back. They opened the cut over his eye again. He was more effective with his straight rights and lefts. He went to the head. He went to the body. He was more effective. The striking was more effective and more damaging, and it went towards more ending the round. You can look at this, and there's points in the fight where you can see that this takes place. 3 minutes left in the round. Sandhagen snaps Dillashaw's head back. 4:24 left in the round. Sandhagen snaps Dillashaw's head back. One 7 seconds left in the round, spinning back fist staggers Dillashaw. The commentary in this round was terrible from all three men. Cruz asked how the judges were seeing how Dillashaw was doing in getting behind Sandhagen and putting him to the cage and holding him there. That was control time, because that's how control time is tracked. Control time can be against the cage, on the ground. It's not a scoring, it's not a primary scoring criteria. And in this matter, it wasn't a scoring criteria because Sandhagen was more effective with his striking. Dillashaw held Sandhagen to the cage, did nothing in that position with effective striking or effective grappling. You could say it was wall install. He held him there. He landed knees to the back of the leg. They were not effective knees. They did not go towards the end of the fight. All he did was hold him there. It's not offense to hold someone there. There's no offense being produced. And that is why, yes, he had control time, but he did not do anything offensive with that control time. There was not a takedown in this round for Dillashaw. He put Sandhagen to the mat for less than a second, and Sandhagen popped right back up. That's not a takedown. That does not get scored as a takedown. That should not be counted as a takedown because he did not do anything offensive after that takedown, alleged takedown, because he didn't improve his position. He didn't land any strikes from there. Sandhagen hit the mat, all fours, got right back up. Not a takedown in MMA. So the commentary, again, bad. A lot of wondering how the judges were seeing things that were not related to the scoring criteria. And I'm going to go over this in detail on my Bloody Elbow report. So make sure you check that out. But there is no way, using the scoring criteria the way it is written, that Dillashaw won the fourth round. Now, the fifth round was maybe closer in the eyes of the judges. In my eyes, Sanhagen still took the fifth round. Dillashaw's output was higher in the fifth, true, but his striking was not as effective as Sanhagen's was. Now, Sanhagen was fighting off his back foot. He was countering, but his counters were heavier and more effective than the strikes of Dillashaw. When scoring a fight, you don't look at, in the primary scoring, in the priority scoring, you don't look at who is controlling anything as a first priority. You look at who has the more effective striking. That has nothing to do with who has the position or who is pushing the fight where it needs to go. That's not something you look at in the priority scoring. You look at the effective striking. And Sanhagen had the more effective striking. His strikes were more immediately heading towards a finish than Dillashaw's. You could see it in the body language. This goes back to what Cormier said, that was the body language was important after the fight. No, the body language is important during the fight. So when Dillashaw was getting hit, he was reacting. He was reacting much more. The straight punches from Sanhagen were crisp and effective, and they either snapped Dillashaw's head back or they stopped him in his tracks when they were effective strikes. And because of that, Sanhagen won. Now, Dillashaw did do some good work. He landed an elbow on a break. He caught Sanhagen a couple times with power strikes that were effective. But overall, the striking of Sanhagen was more effective and went more towards a finish than Dillashaw's. And that's how you score effective striking. Again, the grappling was non-existent. There was another brief takedown, which was not scored a takedown for Dillashaw because he didn't do anything with it. Again, Sanhagen popped right back up. The control time against the cage, not effective grappling. Then there was no effective striking developed off that. There was no offense developed off that. It was just a fighter holding another fighter against the cage and occasionally landing a knee, which did not go towards the effective striking. I'm puzzled by how this round was also scored, and it should have gone to Sanhagen, which would have given Sanhagen the fight. He lost. I think the wrong fighter won. Would I call this a robbery? I don't know. I mean, I think the scoring was done wrong, but I don't know it's hard to say robbery when I look at the full. I look at what Sanhagen did in this fight. He made mistakes that I think contributed to him losing, and I don't think that was the right call. But I think his flashy techniques put him in bad positions a couple times. I think his strikes that were thrown over Dillashaw's head allowed Dillashaw to get in close and attempt takedowns. Now, he didn't land. I think he went 2-for-13 or something like that. And even the takedowns he got, he didn't do much with them. But perception was that when he missed, Dillashaw was able to come in and get in close and close the distance. I think that was something that hurt him. I think that fighting off the back foot hurt him. I think the counters hurt him. None of this should have been taken into account. Let me add that. I think this was all wrong, if any of this was scored against Sanhagen, because that's not how you score a fight. But I think the perception gets in there, and then sometimes judges see, this guy's just backing up. But he's backing up and landing effective strikes. He's backing up and countering. And I think we sometimes get in our heads, the priority is not the priority, in that you still look at all the things to score, because you have to kind of do that. You can't assume that one fighter is going to have the more effective striking and grappling. So you have to focus on the more effective striking and grappling as priority one, but also keep in mind who's doing the, you know, controlling and the secondary criteria. Now, knowing that I don't have to look at that in these fights because the striking was good, I can focus more and give a score afterwards. I mean, which is good for reference, but scoring live is much more difficult than scoring on secondary scoring. So that's why I'm reluctant to call something a robbery. But I would be wrong and out of line if I said that I don't think Sanhagen won this fight. I think Sanhagen won the fight. I think going back and looking at it, you know, and using the tools I have to look at it, he won. But again, that's seconds. That's going back and scoring. You know, and you can't do that. So that's why I'd be reluctant to call it a robbery. I would also say that, you know, maybe Sanhagen uses this as a learning experience. And now he knows what some of the judges are going to look for. He probably shouldn't have to do that because he did everything he needed to do according to the criteria to win the fight. But that's a big issue with the judging. I think judging needs to be more focused on. And I think the commissions need to work more with the judges. And I think they need to review the scoring on fights like this. I know California does that. I don't know if Nevada does it. If they do it, they do it in private. But I would like to see more of the of more transparency here with the judges. Now, the commentary team in this fight, awful. There was a bad commentary in this fight. Most of it was focused around scoring. It got to a point where Cormier said that he didn't know how to score a fight and that he didn't know what he was looking for or looking at. And there were other points where, you know, Cruz said that what was the scoring judges looking at when Dillashaw was holding Sanhagen against the cage. The answer to that should have been nothing because there was no effective offense going on there. And there was comments about takedowns that were not takedowns. Just a general showing that they did not understand what they were looking at and how the scoring takes place. And I think this is one of the things that during the broadcast hurts the judges, hurts the UFC, and affects the commission. If the UFC commentary team does not know how to score the fights, which clearly they do not, because they were talking about things that were not even in the priority criteria, they need to not talk about that. They need to not guess. They need to not show that they do not understand scoring. And, you know, their job really isn't to understand scoring so much, but to offer opinions on something that they don't know about or that they don't completely understand, it gives an impression that the judges are wrong because they look at these folks, Cruz and Cormier, UFC champions, as masters of the subject, and they are not. They do not know the scoring criteria as well as they should, and they showed that. But people, you know, your general mainstream fan is going to take their what they say over what the judges score, and then that creates all kinds of problems. If the UFC wants someone on the commentary team to talk about scoring, excuse me, they need to put somebody on that team who has gone through the scoring classes, gone through the judging, not necessarily a judge, but someone who shows that they understand the scoring criteria and how it is applied, put them on the table, have them specifically speak to the scoring. And that should help 1,000%. because that's not what we have right now. We just have people randomly guessing and making things up on the scoring and making the judges look bad. The judges are, and Andy Foster has said this, he has said, the California State Athletic Commission head, he thinks the judging has been improving. And I don't disagree with him. I think the judges try to do the best they can. I don't think they make mistakes because of negligence. I think mistakes get put under a microscope that aren't really mistakes because of the commentary. And this main event of Saturday was one of the fights that I think showed that. Put somebody on that table that understands top to bottom priority scoring. I don't care if it's a media member. I don't care if it's someone who just went through the judging course. I don't care if it's a judge. I think it should be someone who is not affiliated with a fight team or an active fighter, because biases can creep in. I think they definitely need to have gone through the class or at least show a good understanding of the scoring criteria. And that would improve the broadcast. That will improve the understanding of scoring. That will improve the understanding of the judging and what the judges see. 1,000%. Will the UFC do that? I doubt it. I really doubt it. They should do that, though. I would go so far as to say they need to do that. It will be good for everyone. You know, if there's a question on scoring, instead of having Daniel Cormier and Dominic Cruz ponder what is going on, go to that person. Well, what do you think? You're the expert. What are you seeing that the judges should be scoring? Go there. There's no reason not to. There's no reason not to. If you have to take one person out of the booth and you just have a color commentary person and a play-by-play and a judge commentator, fine. I'd rather have that than just folks guessing, because that helps no one. It doesn't help the fighters. It doesn't help the UFC. It doesn't help the fans. It doesn't help the judges. It doesn't help the athletic commissions. It just causes messes. It just causes problems like we saw on Saturday night. So again, I think Macy Barber lost. I think TJ Dillashaw lost. And I think there is a big gap in the understanding of scoring in MMA. And I'm going to do my best to try and be honest and go through these fights as I need to try and clear that up. And hopefully people will, you know, look at this and consider what I have to say. I know people like to dismiss a lot of things I say, but my entire process of everything I do here isn't to badmouth anyone, isn't to undercut anyone. It's to improve the sport. When I criticize the UFC, when I criticize Dana White, it's to improve the sport, mostly for the fighters. When I criticize the judging, when I criticize the commentary, it's to improve the sport for the fighters, for the fans, for the commissions, for the judges. I want everything to get better. I want this to be a professional sport that's looked upon as a professional sport from top to bottom. We don't have that. And some of the reasons are what I just discussed. So take that for what it's worth. And we'll see if we can get some improvement or at least some understanding of what's going on here. But Saturday night was a bad night. It was a bad night for the commentary. It was a bad night for the judging. And it was a bad night for some of the fighters. And on that note, I'm going to call it a night. It went extra long. Hopefully this was interesting. If not, I apologize, and I'll have shorter episodes for throughout this week. Until then, everyone stay safe. Okay, it is Sunday, July 25th, and time for the post-UFC Vegas 32 wrap-up conversation, whatever you want to call it. I'm going to go over what stuck out for me on Saturday, UFC Vegas 32, and as always, I'm going to start off with the non-fight related issues that stood out. And here we go. First thing is the UFC matchmakers. I don't know what Elise Reed did to deserve to fight Sajara Eubanks in her UFC debut, but that is the fight she got. Reed is a former I think Cage Fury fighter. She only has 4 professional bouts before she fought in the UFC on Saturday, and she had fought as low as atom weight. She was a strawweight, I think, strawweight champion, and then she moved up to featherweight to fight. I'm sorry, flyweight to fight Eubanks, who was coming down from bantamweight, who had a ton more experience in the UFC and just in general. And it came across as a squash match. Hopefully, Reed will get another chance in the UFC and will be able to fight at someone who is more her speed level and, you know, accomplishment level. She just, it was a bad matchmaking job. I did not like this one bit. And I know that Josh Thompson and John McCarthy spoke a bit about this, and Thompson brought this up, and he's 100% correct. If Bellator would do something like this matchup, there would have been a lot of people up in arms. So why is it okay for the UFC? And it wasn't. This was a bad matchmaking job. So hopefully Reed gets another chance. But, and I'll talk a little bit about Eubanks when I discuss the fight, but it was a short story, good performance for her. The UFC seemed to go very easy on TJ Dillashaw and his doping issue, his issue was he got caught doping for EPO, and he said it was to help him lose weight, and said a lot of things, and some people gave him a cookie for, you know, owning up to something that we already knew because he failed a drug test, which you failed the drug test, you confirmed what we know, you don't get an award for that. But UFC in one of the promos referred to what Dillashaw did as a transgression and spoke about him succumbing to pressure. Well, yeah, I mean, if you want to call it a transgression, I guess you could. But the man got caught doping, and that's it. So call it what it is. Be honest about it. Don't try and rewrite history. Don't try and make it something it's not. He got caught doping. He served his time, and that's the end of the story. Let it move on, but you don't have to try and clean it up. He got a suspension. He served the suspension, and he's going to get tested. And if he fails again, well, then he'll have to deal with those repercussions. But he, wasn't a transgression. Wasn't a mistake. Was a decision. He got caught. It was cheating. It was doping. No need to clean it up. UFC Jordan Williams, he is a type 1 diabetic, and during his intro, Daniel Cormier mentioned that he got a sponsor for his insulin, and this was kind of spun as a positive by Cormier, but the thing about this is, if the UFC has its fighters as employees, the odds are very good that Williams is covered under a UFC health insurance policy, and that a sponsor is not needed. His insulin would be covered under that policy. So this isn't a positive for the UFC that he was able to get a sponsor. It was luck that he was able to get a sponsor for his insulin. And the UFC should make its fighters employees, and it should have health insurance for those employees, because these are the people who make the money for the UFC. And someone will say, wait, doesn't the UFC have health insurance? And the answer to that is no. The fighters have injury insurance, not health insurance. Only thing that's covered is injuries while training for a fight with a signed bout agreement. So if a fighter has not signed a bout agreement, they have zero coverage for anything from the UFC. So no, they have injury insurance, no health insurance. So this is not a positive. The UFC should make its fighters employees and cover their health insurance. It does not do that. Looking through and this is going to be the topic of the podcast here, looking through the media, social media coverage from the event, a lot of people were crapping on the judging, and rightfully so. It's never a good thing when the judging is the hot topic coming out of a fight card, and it was definitely that for UFC Vegas 32. So some of that is because of the UFC commentary team and I'll talk about that. Some of that was just because of questionable scoring. None of it is good for the sport or for the UFC or for the State Athletic Commission. Another night of bad judging, bad commentary about judging, and just people not understanding how to score fights, including from what I'm seeing and after reviewing two fights, including the judges. Bad night, bad night. Daniel Cormier had a terrible night. He said that, beside the fact that he just butchered the main event as far as his commentary, and all three of them did in the commentary of the main event when referring to and speaking about scoring. But at one point, Cormier said that body language was important after a fight, and as it goes towards judging. And no, body language is not in the criteria for scoring a fight. Maybe how you react to getting punched in the face and kicked in the head during the fight, that kind of body language, as it shows effective striking, yeah, that's important. But after the fight, raising your hands over your head, that's meaningless. Meaningless. Come on now. Dominic Cruz, early in the fight card, he said that 15 seconds of striking at the end of the third round might have been enough to change everything about the fight as far as the scoring goes. And this made me ask if Cruz understands how fights are scored at all. Maybe that changes the scoring on the round. But on the fight, you don't score a fight. You score round by round. Three rounds, you score it. You hand that in at the end of every round. Five rounds, you score every round. You hand that scorecard in at the end of every round, each round. So you can't go back and say, oh, well, that 15 seconds changed the scoring for the first or second round. No. And when the fight card was, when that fight was scored, I think two judges scored it 30-27. One judge scored it 29-28. And so maybe one judge was swayed by those 15 minutes, but the other two, 15 seconds, but the other two were not. Again, this leads me to believe that the UFC commentary team does not understand the scoring. And I'll talk more about that later. On to the fights. Diana Belbita, which I won't even mention the discussion of her name and how the cheese product would have fit. Cheap joke, but it works. And Hannah Goldie. Now, Goldie looked like the much physically stronger fighter, and she might have been, but that her musculature had, I think, an effect on her striking and on her posture. She was very stiff, and Belbita was much looser. Belbita's striking was more flowing. Goldie's seemed forced. Goldie did an okay job using her strength in the clinch, but she didn't really do anything with that strength. Belbita's striking was much better, much smoother, much more effective, and she just looked better. However, Belbita, even with the win, there are some takeaways here. Against a better striker, she did eat a ton of head kicks, and somebody with a lot of more power and output probably could have rocked her. So Belbita showed some good signs, but also showed some gaps in her game, and I think she's still pretty young. So she has room to grow. Goldie, I don't know if the amount of muscle she carries can really, she might need to reduce that to help her striking, or if it's just her striking in general is not that good. She was stiff, but she also carried her hands in a kind of weird way. They were in between her head and her torso. And the net effect of that was she had really no defense. Belbita could go over her hands or below her hands, so she was leaving herself open for the head and the body. It was a bad, bad, bad guard for her striking. So I liked what I saw from Belbita, but I saw some areas where she could improve. Goldie has a lot of areas where she could improve. Definitely strong, but that's not going to be that can't be the only thing you have in an MMA fight. Eubanks and Reed, again, terrible matchmaking. It felt like it was designed to get Reed, to get Eubanks over. Whether there was a little bit of doubt if Eubanks could make the 125 because she struggled earlier in her UFC career with that. Her coach said that it was the easiest cut of her career. And I think she made 125 and didn't need the pound allowance at the weigh-in. So positive there. Her body composition looked good. She looked like she was carrying the weight well and not sucked out. So I think she has a chance here if she has that weight cut dialed in to make a lot of noise at 125 and make up a lot of ground that she lost early in her UFC career, because being unable to make the weight did mess her up, I think. But she looked really good and definitely ready for a jump up in competition. If the matchmaking was made to see how she would do at 125, we saw that, and expect her to get a very tough fight in her next outing, and expect her to be up for it too, because I think she is going to be hungry and going to want to make up for lost ground. So very good outing from Eubanks, and I expect to see more from her, and just I expect to maybe make a possible run here towards a title shot. Mickey Gall, who is now working with Matt Brown, had a pretty easy go of it on Saturday. He showed improved striking. He showed improved confidence in his striking, but he still fell back onto his jiu-jitsu, which is his bread and butter, probably out of comfort more than anything in this fight. I think if I was his coach, I would push him more in the direction of only falling back to that jiu-jitsu game if he needed to. Gall really needs to build up confidence in his striking, and this fight was a great first step, big improvement, but I don't think he should force the jiu-jitsu, which I think it's what he did here. Just being so comfortable with that allows him to fall back on it, and maybe a fight in the UFC under the UFC lights isn't a place that he wants to test his striking, but he might need to do that. So this was a good win for Mickey Gall, a good show of progress from Mickey Gall, but I would like to see more confidence in that striking, more comfort in that striking, and really push his striking and only fall back to his jiu-jitsu if he has to. MMA is kind of an uncomfortable sport, and you're going to have to be a little bit uncomfortable to improve as an overall fighter. So Gall needs to do that. Again, very good first step and very good progress on his striking. So still 29, so plenty of time for Mickey Gall. And a good performance from him. Ian Heinisch might be on the way out of the UFC. He started out pretty good and then the UFC kind of threw him into the deep end at middleweight pretty quickly. And I don't know if they will do that with the man who beat Heinisch on Saturday, Nazardeen Imavov. But he looked very good against Heinisch. Heinisch was stiff. Imavov's striking was crisp, smooth, comfortable. He just dominated the striking. Clearly the better striker in this fight. Heinisch tried to overpower him. Did not work. One concern I have again from Imavov is he was shaking out his right hand during the fight, so maybe that is damaged. He's only 25. He's got a lot of room to improve and move up. He looked very good, whether that was Heinisch looking bad or Imavov looking good. I'm going to hold off on making that call, but a great performance, I thought, on the level of competition he had here. At 25, I hope the UFC is a little more reluctant to push him up the ladder as they were for Heinisch. I think pushing Hynek up the ladder hurt him. He did not really get a step back, and he might be on his way out now because of how he was booked. Whether that's the UFC or him or a combination of the two, I don't know. But I would like to see a little more time taken with the 25-year-old here who had a good win on Saturday. Yanez and Costa was a hell of a fight, and it was two different fights, really. Costa dominated the first round, but his lack of cardio or care to control his pace or overlooking his opponent cost him dearly, and he was knocked out in the second round. Yanez took over, and Yanez said that his first round was bad, and it's hard to disagree with him. He got dominated in that first round, but he showed resilience and toughness and bounced back and scored a very good stoppage, I think, in the second round. We were led to believe that Costa's output was crazy high in the first round. The fact is that he only threw 17 more strikes than Yanez in the first round. Yes, he landed more, but he didn't throw that many more. Maybe he looked more active because he was damaging his opponent, but overall, it was not a lot of strikes thrown difference, which is concerning because Costa, he faded. And I think Costa, all his wins are first-round finishes. His two losses, I think, are second-round finishes for his opponent. So he needs to dial something in, and, you know, work better at controlling his pace or work better at finishing the fight in the first round. If it was me, I would work better at controlling my pace and upping my cardio just because, you know, you're not always going to get first-round finishes. Barber and Maverick was a weird matchup. Two young fighters and two young flyweights. And it seemed like maybe the UFC was kind of looking at this as a last chance for Barber. I don't know. But she won the fight by decision. She should not have won. And this was one of two fights that I looked at for a scoring, from a scoring standpoint. I scored the second round on this because I think that was the round that made the difference. And there is no way that you could defend the scoring on this round for Barber. It just did not go that way. Maverick was more active, more powerful, landed better in the clinch. She really had a just a better all-around round. The only strike that I found that kind of fit the bill for effective striking for Barber in that round was an elbow she threw in tight. That was nice. She scored a takedown, but that was not an official takedown. It looked like a takedown. She didn't have any control. Maverick got right back up. Maverick scored a takedown of her own and got a strong position and went into a body lock, back control and body lock. Again, that fits the scoring criteria for effective grappling. And so Maverick had a better round. She won that round. If you go by the criteria, Maverick won that round. She had more effective striking, and she had more effective grappling. She got that takedown and advanced her position, got a body lock, back control, advanced the position from the takedown to there. So that is effective grappling, and she definitely had more effective striking. It was an indefensible call, I think, to give that round to Barber, and I would want to know why that was scored that way, because that one was a bad scoring round. So both fighters are young. Maverick shouldn't look back at this fight as it's a loss on her record, but I think everyone that watched this kind of saw that she deserved that win. Barbara can tell herself what she wants, and the judge, and she can do that because the judges scored it in her favor. But the reality is that scoring was incorrect. Using the judging criteria, she didn't have more effective grappling. She didn't have more effective striking. She lost that round, and therefore she lost that fight. But as we know, judging is a problem in MMA. Darren Elkins is a different type of animal, and he proved that once again on Saturday night. So his opponent went out there, had the idea that he was going to overwhelm Elkins on the ground and get a submission. He did not do that. He had Elkins in bad spots, but Elkins was always able to get out of those spots. And by the time the second round rolled around, I forget who he faced, but his opponent had no gas left in the tank. And Elkins, as we know, is not going to fade, and he's not going to quit, and is never going to give up. And he earned a stoppage in the second round, just overwhelmed him. And again, Darren Elkins is one of those guys, I think, who will fight with the UFC until he no longer wants to fight for the UFC, just because he's someone the UFC can count on to always give 100%, always give an up-and-coming fighter a very tough opponent, and just a nasty, nasty dude. No quit in that guy. He'll take whatever abuse he has to get the win. Now, I don't envy him. His future is probably going to be not very healthy. And I think we're going to have to contend with that with a lot of fighters. But right now, while he's still in there at a pretty advanced age for his weight division, Darren Elkins is a different kind of fighter, different kind of man in a sport that's full of different kind of people. Darren Elkins is even more different than those. And that's saying a lot. Pavi and Phillips, that fight deserved fight of the night, but it should have been a draw. The first round was 10-8. I don't know how you could score a 10-9, and then you give the other two rounds to Pavia. I don't know what happened here. I don't know if Phillips underestimated him, overestimated himself, but he really went all out for the finish in the first round, didn't get it, and then had nothing in the second and the third. I give Pavia credit for sticking it out and, you know, hanging in there after being pretty well dominated for the first 5 minutes. So a good performance from him. I would have scored this one a draw just based on the fight first round being a 10-8. But again, only one judge scored it a 10-8. The other two scored it a 10-9. Another fight where the judging was questionable. But the fight of the night bonus was not questionable in this case. Not one bit.